Today is Monday, May 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up.
After more than 650 rockets that Palestinian gunmen fired from Gaza and intensive Israeli airstrikes in response, a ceasefire apparently negotiated by Egypt was in effect.
That's reporter Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Also ahead, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is attending a meeting of the Arctic Council in Finland, and at least 41 people were killed as a result of a fiery crash landing of a Russian Aeroflot jetliner. It's all on today's International Edition. After 2 days of heavy fighting, a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas in Gaza has taken hold. At least 24 Palestinians and 4 Israelis were killed in the latest round of fighting, which does not seem to have achieved much for either side. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
After more than 650 rockets that Palestinian gunmen fired from Gaza and intensive Israeli airstrikes in response, a ceasefire apparently negotiated by Egypt was in effect. Since Israel does not officially negotiate with Hamas, Israeli officials did not mention the ceasefire, but the army said all residents could return to regular activity. Before the ceasefire took hold, Israel carried out dozens of airstrikes on Gaza, killing a number of Palestinians, including 2 pregnant women and a toddler. Israeli officials said they believed one of the women and the toddler were killed by a misfired rocket. On the Israeli side, 4 civilians were killed and dozens wounded. Tens of thousands of Israelis had to run to bomb shelters, and daily life in southern Israel was suspended. Both Israel and Hamas claim victory. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel struck Hamas and Islamic Jihad with great force and is prepared to continue. Hamas spokesman Sami Abu Zuhri said Israel promised to ease restrictions on daily life in Gaza. But many in Israel said the government should not have agreed to a ceasefire. Avi Dichter, a Likud Knesset member and longtime senior security official, said Israel will have to fight Hamas in Gaza again soon. He said that Hamas uses terror for political gains, and Israel cannot allow this to continue. Another round of fighting is only a matter of time, he said, and Israel must reestablish its deterrence against Hamas. The ceasefire comes as Muslims begin to celebrate the holy month of Ramadan, and Israelis prepare for Memorial Day and Independence Day later this week. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Well, the United States is sending an aircraft carrier strike group and bomber task force to the Middle East in response to what National Security Advisor John Bolton said are a number of troubling and escalatory indications and warnings linked to Iran. In a statement late yesterday, Bolton said the moves are being made to send a clear and unmistakable message to the Iranian regime that any attack on U.S. interest or on those of our allies will be met with unrelenting force. The Trump administration did not give details about any particular threats. Among the top stories in the world, Chinese negotiators prepare to travel to the United States for their next round of trade talks after U.S. President Donald Trump complained the process was taking too long and threatened higher tariffs on billions of dollars of Chinese goods. North Korea conducts what appears to be its first ballistic missiles test in a year and a half. And Panama's electoral court proclaims opposition candidate Laurentino Cortizo, a former agriculture minister, the virtual winner in yesterday's presidential election. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Well, aimed at countering China and Russia's expansion in the Arctic, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced today the U.S. will increase its military presence in the polar region. He says the region has become an area of global power and competition. The top U.S. diplomat's warning comes days after a Pentagon report said China could use its civilian research presence in the Arctic to strengthen its military presence. Well, for a closer look at Pompeo's European European trip. We have VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain joining us by phone. Thank you so much, Cindy.
My pleasure.
Well, tell us about Pompeo's, what is his main objective with this trip?
Well, the Arctic is very much in the focus. As you said, there's increasing competition with now, as a result of global warming, shipping lanes opening up in the Arctic, which are very lucrative for a number of countries to get to undiscovered reserves of oil and gas. So the U.S. is very much pushing back at Russia and particularly China, with Secretary Pompeo speaking and a bit mockingly saying there are just Arctic states and non-Arctic states. There are, you know, basically, because China had proclaimed itself a near Arctic state and has been trying to get in on some of the action there. So Pompeo is, this visit is to bolster U.S. diplomatic and military presence in the Arctic region with a visit to Greenland, which is not a place that U.S. diplomats go that often. But the U.S. is also worried that China is encroaching on the territory there.
Very interesting. And also, did Venezuela, what happened with that topic?
Well, we do not have a readout from the U.S. side yet, but the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov has spoken to reporters, and he said that he and Pompeo did talk about Venezuela, and that he had told Secretary Pompeo that any U.S. military intervention in the country would be catastrophic. So strong words from the Russians there on Venezuela, and we haven't heard from Secretary Pompeo yet the U.S. position on how those talks went, but Venezuela was certainly an issue that the two men discussed.
Also at the Arctic Council meeting, were there concerns about President Trump's administration's climate policies?
Yes, that very much is an issue that other countries are concerned about, and with the U.S. sort of tiptoeing around, you know, trying not to alienate other members, but also with the wording on climate change. So that is something that is an issue now and has been for some time.
And what will be the next step after the meeting is adjourned?
Well, Secretary Pompeo travels on and will be in Berlin, Germany, and meeting with German Chancellor Merkel. And they've also had some differences on Ukraine and on Iran nuclear and on trade. And then he'll be in the UK meeting with Prime Minister May after that, and then the stop in Greenland.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's VOA's State Department correspondent, Cindy Sain.
Thank you.
This is VOA's International Edition.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed, voanews.com.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
Well, at least 41 people were killed as a result of a fiery crash landing of a Russian Aeroflot jetliner yesterday at Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport. Shortly after takeoff on a flight to the northern city of Murmansk, the crew sent a distress signal to air traffic controllers and requested an emergency landing. The plane's engines caught fire as the wheels touched the ground on the second landing attempt. The passengers were evacuated through emergency slides. The Russian news agency Interfax reports the plane may have been struck by lightning, necessitating its return to the airport, but the reason for the crash is still not yet known. International Edition's Lori London spoke with VOA Russia Services' Ihar Tisanenko in Moscow.
The death toll is rising, according to Russia's media, and we hear that there is apparently the first possible cause of the crash that was voiced by a Russian official, who at least said that it led to the plane's return to the airport. It was the lightning that hit the airplane literally minutes after it took off from the Moscow's Sheremetyevo airport. The pilot issued a distress signal to their colleagues on the ground, saying that they had some technical issues. The airplane departed Moscow airport at 6:02 p.m. local time, and 27 minutes later, it apparently landed, hitting the ground three times. And after it hit the ground for the third time, multiple engines of the plane caught on fire. And that's what we actually saw on multiple videos that were broadcast on social media. Two children and a flight attendant, we know, are among the dead. One witness said that it was a miracle, literally a miracle, that anyone escaped the jet. Apparently, it's 37 people that survived, but we also know that at least three of them, very, very bad, that condition in Moscow's house.
And is it storming there? Was it storming overnight that there would be lightning?
It was a pretty big storm with very strong winds in Moscow. It was windy. It was rainy. I have not seen or heard lightning or thunder, but apparently, according to some Russian officials, it was exactly the lightning that hit the airplane and it caused it to come back to the departure airport.
It would seem early to be able to really tell exactly what happened, but what do we know about Aeroflot and the type of plane this was in general?
It is very strange indeed. One of the things that we have to note here is that this particular airplane, Sukhoi Superjet 100, it had issues in the past, all kinds of technical issues, and as recently as this year, this actually the past month of April. And we also know that one Irish air carrier refused to purchase this particular type of the airplane, SSJ-100. The Irish air carrier, if I'm not mistaken, was CityJet. It was supposed to be the only air carrier that was wanted to use this type of air jet, but then it opted for not doing so, for not buying them. There will be a very extensive investigation into what has happened.
Do you know who the maker was specifically?
It is a renowned Russian company that produces airplanes. It's called Sukhoi, and the full name of the airplane is Sukhoi Superjet 100.
And this particular plane has had problems, this particular
model. Yes, Sukhoi Superjet 100 had multiple problems in the past, as recently as this year in 2018 and the years before. People who produced the air jet, they were saying they were trying to fix various issues, but it looks like the issues still remain.
Now, the issues in the past, did they ever lead to anything catastrophic like this?
There were some incidents, pretty serious ones. I'm not sure if they led to some crashes of the airplane. I don't think so.
Here in the U.S., if there's a crash, the Federal Aviation Administration oversees any investigation. Is it the same there? Like there's a special governmental agency that oversees these sorts of investigations?
We heard today that Russia's very powerful investigative committee decided to take on this issue and they opened a criminal probe into this incident. I'm sure there'll be very, very significant and very serious investigation into what has happened.
That was International Edition's Lori London speaking with VOA Russia Services Ihar Tesanyenko in Moscow. Well, Pope Francis traveled yesterday to Bulgaria and North Macedonia, two Balkan states with small Catholic minorities he has not visited before. The visits were inspired by St. John the 23rd, who was papal nuncio to Bulgaria, and Mother Teresa, who was born in North Macedonia. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA from Rome.
Pope Francis will spend 3 days in the former communist states of Bulgaria and Macedonia, his fourth trip abroad this year. Both countries have tiny Catholic minorities, and most of the population considers themselves Orthodox. The Pope is likely to use this opportunity to help cement the Vatican's relations with the Orthodox community in Eastern Europe. Ahead of his departure, the Pope sent a message to the Bulgarian people.
La vostra terra e patria dei testimoni della fede.
Pope Francis said his trip to Bulgaria would be a pilgrimage focused on faith, unity, and peace. Bulgaria, he added, is home to witnesses of faith since the times when Saints Cyril and Methodius spread the word of the gospel. This will be the second time a pope has visited Bulgaria. Pope John Paul II traveled to the country in 2002. No pope has ever visited North Macedonia. Bulgaria has a population of approximately 7 million people, with Catholics amounting to only 1%, while Macedonia has a population of around 2 million, with Catholics amounting to less than 1%. Vatican spokesman Alessandro Gisotti said that the trip to these Eastern European countries was inspired by Saints John the 23rd and Mother Teresa. He said the Pope feels he is retracing the steps of these two figures and wants to underscore the good deeds accomplished by John the 23rd in Bulgaria when he was nuncio there for 10 years from 1925 to 1935, and those by Mother Teresa, who was born in Skopje in North Macedonia. Mother Teresa was made a saint by Pope Francis in 2016. She was born in Skopje in 1910, when it was still part of the Ottoman Empire. She became known as the Saint of the Gutters for her work with the poorest of the poor in the slums of the Indian city of Calcutta. Pope Francis will be visiting her memorial and meet poor people helped by the order of nuns she founded, the Missionaries of Charity. Poverty as well as migration will also be themes of this visit by the Pope. Francis will visit a refugee camp in Sofia, which was opened more than 5 years ago as migrants began flowing into Europe. Today it houses some 300 people, mostly from Syria and Afghanistan. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Well, Michael Cohen, U.S. President Donald Trump's one-time personal attorney and political fixer, is headed to prison today to begin a 3-year sentence, in part for helping pay off two women to keep quiet before the 2016 election about affairs they allegedly had with Trump a decade before he ran for the White House. Associated Press reporter Mike Hempen has more.
Michael Cohen is scheduled to begin serving a 3-year prison sentence today for crimes that include campaign finance violations related to hush money payments made on Trump's behalf. Cohen is to report to the federal correctional institution, Otisville. That's a minimum security prison about 70 miles northwest of New York. Once there, Cohen will undergo medical and mental health screenings and be assigned a job, such as mowing the grounds or cleaning up the visiting room. I'm Mike Hempen.
Thank you, Mike. Well, South Africa's national elections next week will be dominated by the African National Congress and two main opposition parties, but there are a panoply of smaller, quirkier players on the ballot, too. VOA's Anita Powell in Johannesburg looks at a few of the upstart parties competing for a piece of the pie.
Are you a Leninite, a free market capitalist, a right-winger, an outspoken lefty, a Sharia law fundamentalist, or just a dedicated pot smoker? South Africa has a political party for you. 48 political parties are contesting this year's national election, leaving voters spoiled for choice beyond the top three, the African National Congress, the Democratic Alliance, and the Economic Freedom Fighters parties. The smaller, newer parties have wildly different aims. Some, like the African Transformation Movement, are church-based. Others are aligned with more traditional political views, or have niche issues to push in national government. But they all seem to share one thing, dissatisfaction with the political status quo. The head of the church-lined ATM party, Vuyuzungula, says they couldn't get the change they wanted through partnership with the ruling ANC.
We believe what the people of South Africa truly need now, they need people that will genuinely serve them. So as the ATM, we're here to serve the people of South Africa, and we're here to make South Africa to be that beautiful country that was witnessed at the time when we defeated apartheid. We're that organization that will work with all sectors of society.
While it's likely the large, powerful ANC will dominate this election, analysts say the small parties play a valuable role in government. South Africa's system of proportional representation means small parties don't need a large number of votes. As few as 50,000 are all it takes to get one of 400 parliamentary seats. That may include the scrappy Dacha Party. Dacha is local slang for marijuana. The pro-legalization party missed the election registration deadline this year, so it instead joined forces with the brand new African Democratic Change Party, which is on the ballot. Professor and analyst Ivor Sarakinski says it's this diversity that makes South Africa's parliament great.
So those parties might be springboards to ask tough questions to the new parliament and the new administration after the election. If they get support, they won't necessarily get big numbers, but their presence will add some real spice to the parliament that's going to be formed shortly.
That's exactly what the tiny 6-week-old Capitalist Party hopes to do. It is only fielding 10 candidates. Not enough to dictate terms on their own, but enough, their leader Kanthan Pillay believes, to play a valuable role in government.
They're all promising that government is going to create more jobs. They're all promising that they're going to cut back on government spending. And they're all promising better levels of education. We don't believe that they have the capability to deliver on any of those things, simply because they lack the expertise to do so.
The Socialist Revolutionary Workers' Party is another new entrant. Spokeswoman Pagamile Khlubi-Majola says the new party was born of frustration with the ruling ANC.
We believe that we represent the aspirations of the 23 million members of the working class of South Africa, whose aspirations have frankly been ignored by the capitalist ANC government for the last 25 years.
At the end of the day, says analyst Angelo Fick, the dominant African National Congress will retain more seats than any other party. But the varied opposition, he says, is a reflection of a healthy democracy.
And so the plethora of choices in front of the South African electorate is not for me a sign of too much too soon. It is in fact a sign of the vibrancy of the contestation around ideas. Most of those 48 parties will get nowhere near parliament, but some of them will have representation in provincial legislatures.
The Rainbow Nation votes in all of its glorious colors on May 8th. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Anti-Islam, racist and homophobic rants on social media have forced several candidates from Australia's main political parties to withdraw from the election campaign ahead of the May 18th poll. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
In this election, several candidates have had to suddenly quit or disavow what they've said on social media in the past. Racist and sexist posts have resurfaced online. Australia's Liberal Prime Minister Scott Morrison has been quick to distance himself from three of his party's nominees.
Those comments are things that I don't share, that I don't accept, and I won't stand for.
Jessica Whelan is one of the Liberal candidates who was forced to quit. She's denied being responsible for a vulgar post that argued women who supported Islam should be mutilated and sold as slaves. But she does admit that she's posted racist comments.
A couple of years ago, I would have made some anti-Islamic posts. I'm not denying that.
Whelan is now running as an independent in the state of Tasmania. And a former Australian MP, Peter Slipper, thinks she may win because of her old social media posts.
A lot of Liberal voters, they would sympathise with that unacceptable sentiment that she has expressed. And I think that a lot of Labor voters would also sympathise with it.
None of the major parties have been immune. The opposition Labor has also dropped candidates because of their offensive jokes about rape, lesbians and Catholics. In the Northern Territory, a Labor nominee, Wayne Kernoth, resigned after it was revealed he'd previously posted an Islamic State-themed photo online and had also shared a bizarre conspiracy theory that claimed the world was controlled by a society of Jewish shape-shifting lizards. Most of these self-destructive posts weren't made recently, but have emerged at a time when they would cause maximum damage. One disgraced candidate said his political downfall was an important lesson for young people that your social media footprint will follow you. And despite being denounced, racism has become a reoccurring theme this election. Candidates with no history of saying or writing racist comments have had their posters desecrated with swastikas and other offensive symbols. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You've been listening to VOA's International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, and our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.